Welcome to Executives After Hours, real conversations with real leaders. This is your host, Dr. James Kelly. I want to make you a promise that over the next 60 minutes, you will learn at a minimum two things. One, every leader and executive makes mistakes on the way to the top. And two, and more importantly, everyone has a unique story to tell. And that's what we do here on Executive After Hours. We sit down with leaders across a variety of industries, and we talk to them about their unique story. So welcome to the community, and stay tuned for today's episode on your Executives After Hours. Hello, everybody. Welcome to Executives After Hours. This is your host, Dr. James Kelly. And yes, I am back in the UAE after a 36-hour trip starting in L.A. through New York to Amsterdam and in L.A. or sorry, in Alain. And I have no luggage, so it's a little irritating. I got to be honest. It's going to take about 3 days for them to get my luggage, but that's all right. Neither here nor there. Everyone's safe. Everyone's happy. And I was super excited to be back in the house to see my kiddos and my wife. But enough about that. Today on the podcast, I have Mr. Tim Sanders. He's an author, lecture circuit speaker, CEO of Deeper Media. His most recent book, Today We Are Rich, is a fantastic book, and we talk a lot about that. It's about his personal story. He's also the author of Love is a Killer App, How to Win Business and Influence Friends. He was Chief Solution Officer of Yahoo back in the day. So Tim and I have a really fantastic interview. But, you know, as I'm trying to produce these short interviews, I had to chop out a ton of just amazing content. So please head on over to my website at drjameskelly.com to get the full interview if you want to hear in greater details. Tim's wisdom is through the roof, if you will. And so, yeah, this is a tough one for me to edit. So go to my website, drjameskelly.com, find and download the full podcast of Tim and I, and have a listen to that, because again, the nuggets are unbelievable. So my trip has just come to a close. My wife brought to my attention, it actually was a 16-day trip, 4 cities, counting travel days. I was only in the U.S. for about 10 days, but I guess 12 days. And so, yeah, so 4 cities in 12 days was quite an undertaking, but, you know, really worth the time. You know, I think I told you last time I was a guest on Legends and Losers podcast. It was live in his garage, 3 hours of just randomness, but it was awesome. I was in New York filming my interview for my book, The Crucible's Gift. Really fantastic time there. And I was in LA moderating 2 panels at the Employee Benefits Healthcare Congress at the Convention Center. Also fun and amazing. So all in all, great trip. It was funny, just really quickly here, and I'll let you get to Tim, is that I actually long to be back in the U.S., which I never thought would happen for me. I tend to be someone who really loves being abroad and doing different things, and it was a challenge for me to come back. I mean, I had to, kids and wife and all, but and a job. But nonetheless, like, it was a real challenge for me. So it was great to be back. Great to see people who I haven't seen in a while. And great to get this excitement building about my book. So, yeah. All right. Let's see. What else? Oh, some early reviews have come back from those who have been awesome enough to review the book. And, you know, the 2 biggest comments that keep coming back, and I think I've had up to 5 or 6 reviews, so that's fantastic, is the readability of it, which I think is huge. So I'm really excited about that, as well as just the stories. You know, the stories in the book sell the book quite a lot. And so those 2 things combined make me really excited about you all reading the book. So if you want to learn more about the book, go to the website, get on the list. And the last little tidbit, and then I'll let you run, is, you know, I'm still trying to collect these stories about individuals' crucibles or individual stories. I'd like to start sharing these stories in November, December period before the book comes out to kind of show how people use adversity to be better leaders. So go to my website, click on the link on the landing page, and just upload your story really quick and just tell me if you don't want a name attached, don't attach a name. If you want a name, give me the name. Just let me know. But I'd like to start sharing those stories sometime in November, December, so that I can you know, resonate. You know, we all have a story and we all have been through some shit. So, you know, come on over to our website, drjameskelly.com. Go to Overcast, hit the star, iTunes, leave a review. Say thank you to C-Suite Radio for the partner. And all right, everyone, have an awesome Monday, and I will see you on Thursday. Bye-bye. All right, today, this has been a rescheduled interview, I think two or three times. Is that right, Tim? I think two times?
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe a couple of times.
It's also funny, by the way, because I listened to your book. Books on audio Audible, and the actor that does your book has a Southern accent, so I kind of just expected you to have a Southern accent, to be honest with you. So I kind of am taken like, wait, who's this? Is this really Tim? Am I talking to Tim? So anyhow, today on the book I have Tim Sanders. You know, he is the author of this is my world. Today we are rich. Harnessing the Power of Total Confidence. There we go. So thanks for coming on.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
Yeah. So you're gonna realize really quick, probably, because I know you're on Doug Sanders' show, The Nice Guys on Business, uh-huh, recently. Doug and I are fairly good friends. I'm only slightly more organized than Doug. So if that gives you any barometer of my organization skills, which means not very.
Well, there you go, man.
Not very organized. So, well, let me just kind of start. We'll talk about the book and we'll kind of weave it in and out, I think, throughout our conversation. I was, you know, I when I listened to your book, this was, I want to say we were supposed to talk in June, and then it got put on hold, and then it got moved one more time. But I was really struck about something in your book. And man, we're just diving right in, by the way. We'll unravel you as we go. But I was struck by the role that your grandma played and how significant the role was. So just to give my audience a little bit of a background, can you just kind of share with me, you know, where you were raised, the circumstances that your grandma had such a major influence with you or on you?
Absolutely. So, I was born in Lubbock, Texas. That's West Texas. And my mother, my birth mother, had aspirations to be a model actress and not a mom. And she abandoned me in Midland, Texas. And Billy, who's my grandmother, this was not the first time that something like this had happened. So Billy decided she would take me in. So she picked me up halfway between Midland and Clovis, New Mexico, where she lived on her farm, and raised me as her son. And from day one, she wanted me to call her mom. This is like when I'm 4.5 years old. And the timing couldn't have been worse for Billy to take in a grandson as a son, because her husband of over 20 years decided to leave her, and he took her teenage boys. And she was heartbroken and, more importantly, broke. Well, not mm-hmm. more importantly, but to compound factors, heartbroken and broke. So we lived on a farm in eastern New Mexico, and we scratched out a living, and Billy realized right away that my self-image was challenged greatly by being abandoned. And she encouraged me so much when I was young, James, so much. And if not to make matters worse, in the second grade, I was put in special education, largely because I was a discipline problem at school and somewhat detached and depressed. But that made the situation worse.
So she had to
really work with me a lot. Yeah.
So, and sorry, periodically, I'm gonna interrupt you because, you know, you're so awesome at telling your story that you kind of get into a zen flow when you tell it. So, yeah. Yeah. So if I interrupt you, I apologize. So there's a question I don't want to forget as we go on. Can you recall your mom abandoning you, or is it just some sort of memory that was just there deeply rooted?
I can recall being in that hotel room for a day and a half, maybe 2 days. I can recall very vaguely the manager of the hotel beating on the door and then eventually someone unlocking it. So I remember that. And I remember distinctly, James.
And you were there by yourself.
Yeah. It's a long story, but yeah, I was there by myself. And it wasn't that she just abandoned me purposefully, she was very forgetful, and she had met somebody and they took off somewhere and she intended to get back, but it wasn't within her control. And she did get back. It was 3 days later. She assumed, I think, that the maids or somebody would find me, feed me, as had happened in the past. But what I distinctly remember was the water tower halfway between that city and where I would be raised in Clovis, where Billy picked me up. And I've passed that water tower dozens of times in my life from the airport going back home to Clovis. So I will remember that that water tower signaled to me the fact that anyone can be saved, so to speak, from any type of situation by love.
So can you recall, because I'm fascinated by this type of stuff from a child psychology perspective, you know, this sense of abandonment. And so I'll kind of give you a similar story from my side, but with my nephews. So my brother and his ex-wife, who's passed, they adopted two brothers that were from a drug mom and drug dad. And, you know, the older one can recall being shoveled around from home to home to home to home until he was probably 5 or 6 when my brother and his wife adopted him. And even to this day, he's now 23. He hasn't got his shit together. Like, he still has an abandonment issue. He has a trust issue. He has, and it's something that doesn't leave you unless you deal with it. And so in your book, what I find really, really interesting is how you and Billy healed each other through different ways.
That's a good way to put it. I mean, I think that the secret to confidence is not to lose twice in a row. And I'm actually lifting a phrase from Rosabeth Moss Cantor's book, Confidence. But she said that, you know, don't lose twice in a row. So I think that for both Billy and I, we did have crushing defeats, but we managed to find a quick win. So
what does
in
that
our
mean?
Relationship.
What does that mean, don't lose twice in a row?
I think adversity sets you back, and it's your job to find a way to move forward. So, you know, I found my little wins where I could. And, you know, the first little win for me was successfully singing at church camp and finding my talent. And that was an important win for me as a, you know, 9-year-old. And for Billy, an important win for her was finding a place to really make a difference with people of the greatest need in town who were just trying to find their next meal. And she would bring that to them. So I guess I'm saying that no matter what kind of adversity comes to you, you have a choice. And your choice is to identify with the adversity or to find an opportunity to win your way out of that circumstance. And you know, James, from studying my life, that being abandoned wasn't the worst thing that happened to me. I've had much worse things happen to me in my life. So I've experienced layers of adversity. But in each situation, the secret to success was moving forward and finding an opportunity to win.
We can unpack that a little bit there, a little bit or a lot, if you like, later on. The word that you used earlier, though, that I thought, and I totally forgot the phrasing of it, was the hero's climb or the hero's journey.
Joseph Campbell writes a lot about the archetypal quest story. They call it the hero's journey, and every great story, every great movie, from Star Wars on, you know, is about the hero's journey. And so I think that for a lot of people, that's the story that we all want to live. And that's the story that's really coded into our DNA. It goes all the way back to Greek mythology. So I think a lot about the difference between a life and the hero's journey.
But I feel like I've over 130 plus interviews, that's the first time I've heard someone describe their path to resilience and success, however you want to define that, as a hero's journey. And what it's, when I hear those words, whether you're borrowing them from somewhere else or not, is that you believe that, because those words to me exude an idea of confidence. So
they do. They exude a self-image that's very strong, where when you look down on yourself, because I've always been able to be out of my body and look at myself from early childhood, I could look down on me and usually be very amused when I'm at my worst. and to be inspired when I'm at my best. And I can see that. I never talk about myself in third person. I hate that. That's ego. That's a whole different animal, right? Yeah. But I've been able to look at myself and say, well, for my first 35 years, I was on the hero's journey, which means that I had ambition. I had grit. I had a specific goal that was bigger than me. I faced adversity. I refused the call. The farm was burned, not literally. That's a Star Wars reference. I had no choice. I had a mentor. I faced real adversity in the middle of the journey, and I, you know, emerged on the other side victorious. First 35 years of my life, I was on the hero's journey. And then since then, the last 20 years, I've been on the mentor's mission, right? So I kind of flip roles. And now what I do with my entire life, everything I do, from writing to speaking to everything, I mentor heroes. That's what I do. And I, by the way, just so you know, James, that doesn't mean I mentor everybody. I shun the takers because that's what makes the world go round. But
how
I
do you
mentor
define a taker? Yeah. How do you define a taker?
This is, well, there's, it's a very complex definition, but I've learned to sniff it out because you've got to improve. If you're going to be a giver your whole life and you're going to be a mentor and that's what you're going to identify with doing, you have to be very careful, because the taker sees mentorship and networking for that matter as a shortcut, and you can tell. So the taker, thinks about what he will get out of a situation. The taker tends to screen other people in their life for value and sometimes dangle the carrot in front of them for, quote, a swap, if you will. But takers are very selfish by design. They have no grand plan of how they're going to make a difference to the world. And I also find they're very cynical in how they think about people like me and you. And so it took me 10 years of that journey once I decided to be a mentor to figure this out. Because in the beginning, I was one of those nice guys, and nice guys get slaughtered in the world of takers because I believe that takers outnumber givers by a lot. I mean, like maybe 5-1 in the world, because that's the natural human condition. You know, when you study Maslow, you kind of get that. Mm. That scarcity is deeply scripted in the average or in the majority of all human beings. So after about 10 years, I figured out, hey, I can make a much bigger difference in my life helping people that will pay it forward. So givers have a tendency to pay forward, not reciprocate. So that's what I mean when I say shunning the takers and feeding the givers. That's what makes the world go around. Every great thing in the world comes from a giver.
So do you think a taker can evolve to a giver?
Yes. I think anything can change in a human being's psyche and DNA. But I believe, to quote Brené Brown or even Scott Stratton, my buddy, you're not the jackass whisperer, right? So I don't think that's ever been my role to rehabilitate someone who is a taker. However, I do accept the idea that I challenge people that are currently mired with the scarcity, quote, not enough to go around mindset. I've challenged them successfully over the course of my life, but that's a little different than a person who at a very deep set level is a taker. This is a person who feels like the world owes them something. Mm-hmm. This is a person who has that horse and sparrow mentality that if they are successful, the sparrows of the world will be fed, through their wealth generation. So I think they can change, but usually it requires a significant life experience for that to occur. I'm not so sure that you can coach someone to be generous per se. You can coach them to believe there is enough to go around and to be a bigger dog in a fight, right? So you can coach someone to let go and share a little bit, but that doesn't mean they've become a giver.
So, so I'm going to throw myself out there as someone who, as you were describing that, I'm thinking, God, am I an ass or am I strategic or am I, so I'm trying, so I'll lay my own soul to bear in this conversation, because I think this is a really interesting conversation about how can someone be strategic with their career and utilize relationships to create win-win situations. Is that the same thing as
a taker? You're getting to a good question. And for listeners, I advise you go Google one of my buddies, a social researcher, Adam Grant at Wharton, who wrote a book called Give and Take, and he deeply studied the psychology of givers and takers, and it's a great read. But here's the idea. When you give to someone and you expect reciprocity, you're likely really a taker. Mm-hmm. Because you're mm-hmm. swapping. You're not really giving. You're investing in people, hoping for a return.
You have an expectation.
When you give to, you have an expectation of reciprocity. Mm-hmm. When you give to someone and your expectation is pay forward, in other words, you put somebody together and you create a life-changing opportunity with them by making an introduction. They come back to you. They're like, James, what can I do for you? And you scold them. You say, nothing. That's not why we're doing this. This is not a swap. Mm-hmm. I want you to find that person in your future who is at the same crossroads and help her. So what I've learned is the givers of the world coach pay forward, and it is a tendency, and they never measure payback. And that's one of the most important assumptions that a person can adopt if they want to be generous their whole life. If you assume that your recipient is paying it forward, you will never be disappointed by giving.
So, I mean, I think... So I agree with that. So for me, it's a struggle, right? Because I think people take advantage. And so I think this is probably your point of saying a giver. So, you know, I'm someone who will always make introductions to two people. Oh, I know someone here. Let me introduce you. And I have no problems and no expectations to get it back. But when I say, let's say 6 months down the road, hey, I'm looking for someone who does X. And I know that they have a network of people that do some of that, but they say, no, I don't know anyone. And I'm like, well, wait a second. Like, I want to help you out in this situation. You were looking for someone who does, you know, this type of consulting. I'm looking for someone for this type of interview. Why won't you help me out? And then, unfortunately, for me, I take it personal. Like, well, what did I do? Like, what's wrong with me? Which is a whole other episode and topic, so don't worry. But I find that interesting, this giver and takers, because I feel like if you give a lot and then the other person never reciprocates down the road, when you're asking for a favor, then I take offense to that. Not because I expect them to help me out, but it would be nice if they had the, or maybe I do expect it, I guess, but maybe it would be nice if they had the compassion and caring to go back the other way as I was trying to help them out for no reason. Like, the initial, like, let me make a connection, I have no expectations, you know, at least in my mind, but maybe I do. I don't know.
Yeah. So here's the thing. One word, three times I'll say it. Technique. When I first started being a giver, I was provisioned and often taken advantage of, and then I figured it out. I figured it out that when you invest in people, you invest a little upfront and you're willing to lose whatever you invest. It's mm-hmm. usually just a little time. You invest much deeper when they demonstrate a pay forward heroic tendency, and you go all in when you know for a fact they are a hero. Mm-hmm. And that's the way I approach everyone. So I'll help anyone a little. I have a phrase, James. I say I'm often provisioned, but I'm never taken advantage of. What I learned, and I wrote about this in my first book, Love is the Killer App, is that if you share your intangibles smartly and you improve your technique daily and you observe from those times you are disappointed in the other, you will get better at picking the right people. But let me also say this about networking. So when I introduce two people, I've become much more careful about it because my network is my net worth. That's a mantra of mine. It is so true. So when someone needs to meet someone, the first question I have to ask myself is, do I know somebody? Check. The person I know, will they mesh personality-wise with this person I'm about to introduce? Check. The most important thing I want to know is, does this person asking me for an introduction, do they consider networking a shortcut? Are mm-hmm. one of 1,000 steps. And that's the key. Most people that don't pay you back see networking as a shortcut. That's mm-hmm. why they forget about you. But anyway, let me just kind of also say that the best networking introductions I've ever received, the best opportunities that have ever come into my life, weren't necessarily from people that I helped. It was from people that heard about me mm-hmm. from someone that I helped, right? Mm-hmm. So I think the secret to getting introduced to the right people, and this is what I want you to take away from it, James, is you must demonstrate insane value add. Otherwise, you're not worth introducing. Not everybody's as generous as you are. Mm-hmm. The average person introduces someone to their network that has demonstrated insane value. So that's what I always say is I go back to you and say, well, you know, if someone failed to introduce you to get a guest on your podcast, what you've got to do is you got to look in the mirror and say, what have I done mm-hmm. to prove that being a guest on After Hours generates insane value? And I've had this conversation with a lot of podcasters who've demonstrated the same disappointment, mm-hmm. you know, that their network they've invested in is not coming back with them. And I think that that's a really important thing to take away from us, that we all kind of own that piece of reciprocity. Sure. But I think that that if you look at the people that you've helped, unless you made a bad match and lost a friend, you generally didn't lose much by making that introduction. But if we believe in karma, and I do, I deeply believe in karma, that person who took from you and gave nothing in return, even when you asked, they're worse off for that, and they know it. And it really, they may not know it at the conscious level, but their subconscious knows that they're a taker. And that's a terrible thing to think about oneself.
Well, I think it's a fantastic and interesting conversation. You know, I think for a lot of people, it's a struggle, right? So again, I'm always open to help whoever needs help and have very little expectations coming back. I think part of that's being raised in my family of a lot of takers. And so I've just kind of the expectation of, you know, can I borrow money? It's not borrow. You can have it. So anyhow, I kind of want to go back.
Wait, can I say something really quick? So that's interesting. I just want to chirp in a little bit. I never lend money. I never give money. I have one specific charity I give to. I don't give tangibles at all. And the reason why is because when we give tangibles, I believe, again, this is just me personally, I believe we put ourselves in a situation to be greatly disappointed because there's only so many tangibles, right? Mm-hmm. I can network infinitely, right? I've never lost anything by networking, but if I write somebody a check, like I don't loan money, I don't give money, I don't do anything with money. I live off my money, and I have one charity that I give to equal to a tithe that I feel very good about, and it's private. I don't talk about it because I don't believe we give to brag. But I made a decision about 20 years ago that I will only share intangibles that grow as they are given away, and there's only three of them in the world: your knowledge, your network of relationships, and your human compassion. Mm-hmm. And dude, that's been enough.
When you listen to your book or read the book, for those who still read, I just happen to listen to a lot more. You know, the concept of Billy came up again and again because she was such an integral part of who you are as an individual and the growth that you went on in your life. As you got older, you know, I kind of mentioned this earlier that you guys healed each other, it seemed like to me in the book. Did you reflect on that concept that you healed Billy as well as she healed you?
No, I didn't. I never really thought about it till I was writing the book. You generally don't see that from the outside, right? It was almost like editorial discussions with Tyndale where they were like, wow, I mean, you really made a big difference to Billy. And I had never thought about it that way. I mean, she was the matriarch of our family. She was, in my mind, the greatest human being that ever lived. And I just saw it that way. And I saw her saving me on three different occasions throughout my life over a 31-year arc. And that was the way I saw it. And, you know, it's almost now in retrospect where I feel that I did maybe help her too.
So I think
it was more the opportunity to raise me helped her. The opportunity to redeem herself with me helped her. I think that was really the biggest thing for her.
Well, I think that was clear is that for lack of a better term, you were her do-over.
Exactly.
Yeah.
She always believed that things like this were opportunities, not obligations. And she used to say that, I didn't put it in the book, but she said, you know, you have no obligations, only opportunities. And that is the abundance mindset.
Mm-hmm. And that is so true. I'm a very opportunistic individual about what's in front of me and how can I make this lemon into lemonade, essentially.
Exactly.
And so, you know, you keep mentioning these three major crucibles in your life beyond being, left by your mom. What was the next major event that kind of helped transform you?
Second grade, put into special education. Nickname at church became Short Bus. I was very ostracized as a little kid. You know, it's bad enough to be raised by your grandmother on a farm and everybody knows that your mom abandoned you, so they're going to give you a hard time for that. But
Sure. Just
go to special education in a small town at the downtown library with the other six kids that were all outcasts, and it really becomes tough. Mm-hmm. At the end of fifth grade, I had finished all of the junior high school curriculum at that special education program. This is the 60s, so they didn't really have much development for this. So they had no choice.
But what did that do to your psyche during that time period? I mean, there's a really developmental time period in your life between second and fifth grade. You know, there's a big theory that by age 12, you're kind of who you are.
Yeah, well, I kind of defy that, right?
So, well, totally. So that begs a bigger question.
There's always outliers. And I'm a researcher like you are, so there's always outliers. So I'm clearly, you know, an outlier with respect to childhood and stuff. But anyway, I don't really remember. I mean, what I identified myself with I think between second and fifth grade was that I was a survivor.
Talk to me about the third major thing that happened that you said wiped off 10 to 12 years of your life.
Okay. So, you know, senior class president, I joined the debate team, was state champion when I was in high school, national junior college champion whenever I was in junior college that first few years. I was recruited by Loyola in Los Angeles, full boat scholarship, top recruit that year. At the end of my sophomore year, it was widely expected that I would win the national four-year school championship the following year. And over the summer, my father, who I had never lived with, I had just seen him during the summers, he was tragically murdered. And he and I had really warmed up to each other during my later high school and early college. And his intention was to relocate to Los Angeles and we were going to live together. And I always admired my father. It's just he had an extreme lifestyle and knew better. He knew he couldn't raise me, that his mom, Billy, would be the best person to do that.
That's and what I was going to ask you. So that's how you ended up with your dad's mom.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. My dad was an outspoken gay rights activist. He even passed out needles in San Francisco. He was murdered in a hate crime. He worked for milk. So anyway, and I didn't know any of that. It's like it all happened at one day. You know, your father's been murdered and this and this and this. I knew nothing about him. So you can only imagine when I got back to the house and Billy was like, come over here, let's pray. I was like, we're not going to pray because right now I'm not feeling it, you know, with this God thing, right? Because why would this happen? Why does this stuff keep happening? We're really good people. So anyway, I kind of rejected everything she taught me in that moment. And I kind of went on back to college and I was a bust. I mean, you know, we were competitive nationally. I made the elimination rounds a few times, but I never accomplished my potential in college because I was so focused on this loss and so identified with this tragedy. And I was kind of, you know, I drank too much. I was negative in my personality and it kind of carried forward to my early adult life. And then one day in the mid 1990s, after this had dragged on for 12, 13 years, I'm sitting in bed and I'm reading this book that my wife had recommended I read called The Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. Mm-hmm. And there was just a part of that book that, you know, talked about the idea that if nothing else, the people around us deserve so much better. Mm. And that one of the reasons we've got to strive for effectiveness is for the sake of those we love and care about, you know, regardless of how we're scripted, no matter how deeply we're scripted to believe a certain thing. And Dr. Stephen Covey wrote that the abundance mentality comes from a deep sense of self-worth and the belief there is enough to go around. And as I read that, I slapped the book shut and I said, man, my wife and my son deserve that champion. That guy in 1980 who was on top of the world. So I called Billy and I talked to her. I just never listened to her since that tragedy. We talked. I really loved her. And I called her and I said, Mom, I said, I want to be that guy again. I want to be that guy that ran for senior class president and surprised everyone. I want to be that guy that was number one in the nation. I want to be that guy again. So she asked me the most important question, the one I ask everyone who I coach, who's ready to stop going sideways. She said, okay, it sounds like you're ready. She goes, let me ask you this. What are you not doing today that you were doing back in the day when you were on top? And I struggled to take the question seriously, but I was at such a turning point psychologically. I went ahead and thought about it more. And when I realized all the things I had been doing, like helping so many people, being so encouraging to those no one encouraged, promoting other people's success ahead of my own, I realized all those things were absent from my personality. So immediately I returned to studying on behalf of teaching. In other words, I returned to the idea to learn deeply for the purpose of teaching. I returned to the idea of finding those people in my life that I could help that no one else would help. And I'm telling you, within 2 years of that moment, not only do I have my personality back, now I'm working for Mark Cuban at his famous startup in Dallas, the one he sold to Yahoo. Yeah. And within 4 years, I was chief solutions officer at Yahoo, who at the time in 2000 was on top of the world. And I always trace it back to that seminal moment when she asked me, what are you not doing today that you were doing when you're on top? And I think that for a lot of people, that can be the question that will help you turn yourself around.
So I just have one more question for you. And actually, I do have a couple more questions. I was just really curious about this. Did you, and I can't remember if this was in the book or not, so I apologize. Again, I read it in June, and I don't have a system for memories, so I need to come up with one probably. Did you ever reconnect with your mom?
Oh, yeah. Oh, you mean my real mom?
Yes, yes.
No. The best way to know is that she also was killed at some point, probably in my teen years, but it's fuzzy. No, I never did.
Oh. And did you ever, was Billy able to fill that void of never knowing your mom?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I believe that. I believe that mom is who you call mom. I've kind of always defied the whole blood is thicker than water thing.
And then now your son is obviously older and adult. So has he followed in your suit at all? Have you been able to give him your strategies and tactics in life?
Yeah, he's his own remarkable young man. When I met my wife, Jacqueline, she had him. He was almost 4 years old, kind of similar to the age I was when Billy took me in. So when we got married, I, much like Billy, raised him as my own, although he's had his father around his entire life, too. And I've learned to become best friends with his dad. That's the abundance mentality. You make a choice about that. So my son, Anthony, is his own remarkable young person. And he's learned to take away from me the best parts that are most relevant to what's going on in the world today. And then he has some absolutely fantastic qualities of his own that he took away from his mom, as well as the people that he's been around in his life and his father for that matter.
That's awesome. So, all right, last question that I have for you, Tim, and I appreciate your time and energy to sit down with me. I ask this of everybody, and so I'm just kind of curious how you're going to answer it, is how do you define happiness?
The absence of negative thoughts.
That could be.
We are naturally happy. We are naturally happy human beings, but I really subscribe, again, going back to the Dalai Lama and Buddhist thinking that happiness or joy or whatever you want to call it is merely the absence of negative thoughts and negative thinking.
Do you think that you're an intense person?
Oh, dude, absolutely. You should have seen me last night when the Cowboys played the Giants opening day. I was going to throw my shoe at the TV on a bad call, but my wife discouraged me from that. Yeah, I'm an incredibly intense person.
Yeah. I got that sense where I'm a bit more like relaxed, you know. So you're like on point when we're talking. Like,
but you know, let me apply that to your thing about happiness. Yeah. So the way my intensity applies towards that is I eschew negative people. Like I freak out when someone coughs next to me on a plane because I don't want to be physically sick either. Yeah. So I unfollow people. I unfriend people. I shun people who are going to try to put negative things into my life. I don't watch cable television. I don't even want to know what the latest scare merchant's saying to freak people out, right? So I find that I am aggressive in designing negativism out of my life. And for those that say, well, Tim, that means you're sticking your head in the sand. No, I employ Napoleon Hill's mastermind group theory. While I get rid of the negatives, I found a trusted circle of really smart people who do research for the right reasons, and I absorb what they say. That teaches me what I need to understand about politics, economy, socioeconomic development, corporate work, etc. So I take in less media information than most of all the people I know, but I still consider myself well informed. I just sincerely believe, James, that positive thinking is a design issue, not a motivational issue. It's not about a person's integrity and grit and character. Positive design is about their awareness of what is coming into their purview, their willingness to frame the news as good, bad, or get busy, not just good or bad. There's a lot of design decisions one must make if they want to think positive in this world.
So listen, Tim Sanders, thank you for your time, your energy, your willingness. This was not a typical interview. Definitely was way, way more organic even than I have from an organic conversation standpoint. So I really appreciate you coming on the show.
Absolutely. For those listening that want to dive more into Today We Are Rich, I just want to say this. You can download the entire chapter, Feed Your Mind Good Stuff, which is about using design to be a positive thinker. And that is parked at twar.com/free. That's twar.com/free.
Awesome. And just remember that, you know, the most recent book is Today We Are Rich, Harnessing the Power of Confidence. You can get that at Amazon and I'm sure Barnes & Noble and every other possible outlet, if I was to guess. So, all right. Thank you, Tim, so much. And I'll put all this in the liner notes for my audience.
Absolutely. My pleasure, James. Great talking to you.